Wall Street and biotechnology companies have been very excited about this idea. And what essentially it is trying to pack the cells in the body in order to make them into drug factories.
Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
January 23rd, 2021. Thank you for joining me today. I got to remember that that clip has to do with COVID. That's not what I meant to play in that opening clip there. Today is only going to be about foreign policy. It's a special Daily Wrap-Up that is, for the time being for this show today, only focusing on what is happening around the COVID illusion, what's happening in other countries, what's being ignored by the very people so sanctimoniously claiming they care about human life. And joining me today for this special edition is, of course, Robert Inlakesh. Thank you so much for joining me today, brother. How are
you? Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm good.
Good, good. Yeah, good as we can be in all of what's going on today, I'm sure. But yeah, it's great to have you on, man. I mean, this is, as everyone knows that's been following this channel or the Daily Wrap-Up in general, I had a very strong focus on foreign policy because obviously I think that at the moment, in my opinion, was the largest thing happening in regard to all the other agendas that fit into it. I clearly think that's COVID-19 today. I think that's the biggest thing happening on the planet, but I think that the foreign policy around it is part of that same agenda. And that's kind of the thing that, you know, we're seeing all these things seem to fit together. But so I wanted to have you on today to go over what is not being seen, even on the Daily Wrap-Up, you know, that we're focused on things internally and we're not seeing all the horrible things happening around the world, such as Syria continually being bombed or, you know, violations of airspace or all the horrible things going on, including things that seem to be coming directly from the administration of Joe Biden. So let's start off today before we get into the other, you know, any number of locations we're probably going to talk about today, Iraq, Lebanon, and so on. I want to point out a great article that you just did, that you just wrote, entitled U.S. Foreign Policy Under Joe Biden Does Not Look Promising. Now, this is a great article because it goes over some, and you know, a lot of this is speculation, and rightly so, because we don't know where this is going, but we have to, you know, use what we have in front of us. So what is, in your general opinion now going forward, what do you see being the focal point of Joe Biden, or, you know, what we can see so far being the focal point of Joe Biden's administration in regard to foreign policy? And do you think it's any different than Donald Trump's administration?
Well, there's very little difference. Even we look at Venezuela, for instance, it looks like Joe Biden's administration is going to recognize Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, as the president of the country over Maduro, which, of course, this is something that Donald Trump attempted to do. And he attempted to install him via a coup, which failed, and the economic sanctions. And we've seen talk from the Biden administration that they are going to essentially up the sanctions. And that would be a good strategy in order to punish Venezuela. When we've seen that that is a failed strategy, for one, it does not work. And on top of that, it just causes more untold suffering for their people.
Right. Well, I would argue it works exactly the way that they want it to work, but not the way they tell us it should work, right? Just like you said, they're punishing Venezuela, not the government. They're hurting the people of that country in hopes of driving them to revolt against their government, which is what they're actually designed to do.
Yes, exactly. This is the real reason for sanctions being imposed upon countries. It's to weaken the country's government, its leadership, and its ability ultimately to provide for its citizens. And so if the government can't provide for its citizens and the citizens are essentially starving, then they will turn to extreme means. And if they're given, of course, arms, or if they're backed up with U.S. money or money funneled in through wherever they want to funnel it in through, then they will go along with whatever agenda. And this is just what happens with poor people. People want to eat. People want to survive. Right. Provide for their family. Well, so we see this in Iran and Syria, etc.
Right. And well, that's an important thing for people to understand, is that we, especially in America, Americans don't seem to really grasp how severe that can be in a situation where it, you know, you, it doesn't matter how much you support your president or your government. It gets to a point to where, okay, well, my child hasn't eaten in 2 weeks, so I don't really care what happens if long as we're not going to die. And the gov- and the U.S. government knows that. Then if you go back far enough, it's not even secret. Like, this has been stated, as you probably know, numerous times about how you, I mean, Kissinger has a lot of quotes about exactly why this is meant to be, you know, bring them to their knees, essentially. You know, I mean, Pompeo was even caught in regard to Iran. I shouldn't say caught, stating, didn't realize it would go everywhere, that, well, if you want your people to eat, then you do what we say. And I don't even know how they managed to, like, PR that away, but it's like you're blatantly telling them, we're going to starve your people if you don't do what we say. It's incredible. It really is.
Yeah, and it's the exact same thing we saw last year inside of Lebanon. Lebanon, of course, has been hit hard, not only by sanctions on Lebanese banks, for instance, linked to Hezbollah, they say. And this is the main crux of what they're doing inside of Lebanon. They want to destroy Hezbollah and any group that wishes to resist against imperialism in the region, and Israel as well, encroaching upon their territory. But with that as well, it's the sanctions that were imposed upon Syria, especially for this newer Caesar Act, they called it. Donald Trump called it, which essentially cripples the economy of Lebanon even further, because Lebanon and Syria are like really Lebanon's only border for trade. Everything has to come in through Syria. And on top of that, with the port explosion, which happened, that knocked out 70% of where, you know, imports and exports would come from. So it's extremely difficult. And again, there, the pressure was put on, and we saw that the U.S. Ambassador inside of Lebanon was trying to get involved in internal affairs to do with Lebanon's Hezbollah, which is a political party involved inside of the government there, and also, of course, a registered terrorist organization, according to the United States, when they're not supposed to be doing that. So you're exactly correct in the analysis, and of course, bringing up what Pompeo said, that it's about starving the people, making the people as poor as possible in the hopes that perhaps they could stir up civil unrest in order to remove a government or party or whatever it may be.
Which appears to be happening in Russia right now, the whole setup, and we'll get to that in a minute. I want to point out how I just want especially Americans to recognize how, you know, imagine if 9/11 had happened, you know, not even getting into who and why and how, but that happened in this country and everyone else in the world was like, yeah, that was their fault. It was their incompetence. They didn't do something right, or they didn't do this, and we don't care about everything that happened, as opposed to everybody everywhere saying it was the biggest deal in the world. Right. So that's what this was. This was Lebanon's 9/11, and nobody cared. It was forgotten 2 days later. And that is what this is, the kind of foreign policy that ties in with the media manipulation that we see today, that these things don't matter, despite the fact that there are people's lives. And by the way, I should be clear, don't to them. It matters, and it should matter to anybody honest, but that's really incredible. But before we get on to other stuff, let me ask you, taking sort of a step back, in your mind, and for people that haven't seen your other coverage, because you know you've gone through this pretty in depth, what do you see happening with all of this, like in the larger picture, right? So you have bombings in Syria, attacks in Iraq, you've got violations in Lebanon, obviously what's happening in Palestine, you know, all of this together, not just from the U.S. or even just from Israel, maybe that's all you see it as, but what's the bigger agenda here? What do you think they're trying to accomplish? I know it's a big question, but and how does it all sort of fit together in your eyes?
Well, I see it as the exact same agenda under the Trump administration, Obama administration, Bush administration before that as well. Complete domination of the entire region. And we're not just talking about the Middle East here as well. They want dominance throughout the world. And so if they have to achieve that through economics, or they have to achieve that through military intervention, they'll do that. What we've seen with Biden already is that Biden is poised to put more troops into different countries, for instance, into Iraq, into Afghanistan. We've seen the U.S. put more troops into Syria. That's just happened to secure the Al-Anwar oil fields there and carry on with what the Trump administration was doing. And Trump openly said this in terms of Syria, that they're there and they've got the oil, they've secured the oil. And so when we're looking at their agenda here, it's clear that inside of the Middle East, the Biden administration is not looking to get out of any of these conflicts. He wants to exacerbate them. And I think the key thing here to understanding this, instead of people going and having watched the Biden inauguration, I would advise people, it's 4 hours long. I watched the entire thing. Perhaps you don't want to watch the whole thing, but maybe some highlights from it, was the Senate confirmation hearing in which Antony Blinken, the new Secretary of State for Joe Biden, was basically laying out his foreign policy positions. And so from that, you can get the direction of the Biden administration. For instance, we look at the Iran nuclear deal, JCPOA. He was saying that we're not going to get in it, back in it anytime soon. And they were wanting to essentially condition getting into that deal. And a big primary aspect of getting back into the JCPOA for the United States would be to stop the ballistic missile program and their Iran's alignment with its neighbors, countries and organizations, which it has aligned itself with. The only place where it differs is perhaps in Yemen, where they have stated that they will try and perhaps end their support for the Saudi coalition's war on Yemen. However, we haven't seen anything go through on that yet. We haven't seen any steps taken towards that yet. And the first step here, even if they were, for argument's sake, that they do go ahead and people believe that they're going to go ahead and pull their support from the Saudi-led coalition and its attack on Yemen and the war that is going on there, essentially, will they shift, for instance, and go and support the Emiratis, who back the Sovereign Transitional Council there, which are a warring faction inside of Yemen. Sorry, and will they, for instance, reverse this decision to register Ansar Allah or the Houthis in Yemen, which are the main and the most important factor here in terms of if you want peace in the country? Will they reverse the designation of the Houthis or Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization? That part is the most key thing here, because if the Biden administration does not reverse that, and it said that it will look at it and review it, but if it does not reverse that, even if they end the Saudi bombing campaign by pulling support away from them, that doesn't matter, because there's no aid which can get into Yemen, which is the number one humanitarian crisis in the world. And if we look at the World Economic Forum, for instance, they've stated that 2 million children are essentially in like abject poverty, like starvation. So this is a key element there. It does look like they are taking sort of an anti-Saudi line, but that could be for many different reasons. Perhaps they want to pressure the Saudis. Perhaps they're wanting to push them in a certain direction. Maybe they're not happy about coming together with Qatar again. Maybe there's a number of different things, or it could be to do with getting close to Canada again and raising the prices of oil. So when we're looking at this administration and the way it's sort of poised to attack at the moment, we have to look at it in its proper context. Joe Biden's not for ending any of the wars. Joe Biden's for the wars. Antony Blinken was there, the right-hand man for Joe Biden and Barack Obama. And then on top of that, look at who's leading the Pentagon now. This has been widely praised by these identity politics people as being a great achievement with Lloyd Austin. Sorry, Lloyd Austin is a former 4-star general who was the man to he was branded as the man who was the brains behind the assault on Baghdad in 2003, which of course resulted in a bloody massacre in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. He's also the man who in the second term of the Obama administration was a large part to play in the planning of the Syrian proxy war, which we saw going on. And his strategy of training up these U.S. troops and U.S. proxy forces and putting them into battle completely failed. And all of the financing in that went to Al-Qaeda-linked groups. It went to the most radical elements and resulted in more bloodshed. And of course, we saw the U.S. assaults on Raqqa and other areas as well, with bombing civilians, providing air support multiple different times for Daesh or ISIS. Mm-hmm. And so that's the man, and not just like pointing out his war crimes, for instance, this man and his involvement in Afghanistan as well. We have to look at, this is a man in a position leading the Pentagon, which is usually claimed by a civilian. So they're putting a military guy in this position and they're going, oh, wow, look at the color of his skin. Like that matters.
Right.
when he has the record he has.
And it's an important point that most Americans don't even know, right? And that's what's so interesting is that these are little nuances that they don't notice or catch. And most Americans will go, oh, the Pentagon, that doesn't, why would even balk at that? And these are little shifts, like you're pointing out in your article, that are definitely indicating a military focus, you know? Right. And I think it's the same point I've made in a lot of different points. I was talking about the I forget the actual title, but the woman in regard to health with COVID-19. And it's not, it's just about the identity. Right. It's, well, she's transgender, so it's a success, except she's got a horrible record with doing things we don't agree with and probably the least qualified person. I mean, there's all these things, but it doesn't matter. Right. It's, you got your token person. Here's your token black person, your token transgender. And that has nothing to do with how good they are at their job. Aside from that, I would agree, or I would argue, that almost always the people in these positions are exactly like this guy we're talking about. But they use the identity to overshadow, or rather just completely ignore, that this guy is, should not have this position if we are actually considering past actions. You know, they are driving this in a way that they want that to be the case. Obviously, they want more wars. They want more actions like this, but they would never admit that, you know? Go ahead.
Well, even with Austin being placed in like this position heading up the Pentagon, he, according to U.S. law, you're not supposed to be in that position if you haven't been retired from the military and right. been in civilian life for at least 7 years. And so there had to be congressional approval to have him in that role, which a lot of people don't understand. And like you said, it's just, oh, well, we have the token this or that, and there's this amount of women on the team, and there's this amount of black people or Mexican people or whoever it may be that they're putting in positions of power. But the whole thing with, for instance, positive discrimination as an idea, especially when it comes to government, is that you're having a representation. These are government members. These are supposed to be a representation of constituents, of Americans, of their given communities. And so if you have positive discrimination, it's supposed to be that you have a person from a certain community who's going to represent the views of that community. So if you have an African American in charge of whatever position it may be, then you're thinking that, well, this is a good thing because this person maybe is going to do something for their community. But that's not the case. And I say this to people all the time. I've had many discussions with people who are on the left, and they say to me that, you know, you should be as well. They're saying to me, like, well, you should be for this because, you know, you're about, you know, ending discrimination and all the rest of this. I said, yeah, I would be with you in theory. But this person is like, for instance, you would not support Candace Owens taking that position, would you? Because Candace Owens, she doesn't represent the majority opinion of African Americans, and she's hated for her views largely. So, and when we look back at the Bush administration, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, like, how did they change anything? Was that somehow like something that we should place up and say that's a wonderful thing that happened, that we have these two individuals right. in power? What did they do? They were part of the war machine. And so we can't say that just based upon identity. I mean, if Obama didn't change anything significantly for African Americans, like for African Americans, just like put away his focus on war, what he did in terms of bombing 7 different countries, upping the drone strikes, everything else, invasion of Libya, the war in Syria, etc. We can put that aside for a second and just look what he did for African Americans, and nothing fundamentally changed. And so right. why are people still stuck on this?
Well, the point that I keep making in that regard is that, you know, it's not even, I mean, that's a valid point, but I would argue there's a lot more around that that could influence that whole discussion. But at the same time, regardless of whether that's the case or there were other factors in the way or however you look at it, just the simple point of saying it's a great thing because he's black or because she's a woman is inherently racist itself. You're implying that they're lesser than because, you know, and that they get the job. It's like, yay, finally they got it. You know, and of course they're also arguing that it's the societal part of that, but it's fundamentally undermining. That's what I made the point about Kamala Harris the same way. And I fight for literally everybody to have a voice and everybody. And you know, all this, I mean, this is basic stuff. We care about human beings, regardless of what they're like or what they, you know, look like. But this is stupid to argue that. And, you know, just that makes a difference. But this is where it's all going. And like your point was that all of this stuff is overshadowing what these people really are and what they're really actually accomplishing underneath what they look like. I mean, it's really insulting that that's what's the discussion here. Like, as you know, it's just I love the inherent hypocrisy of these movements, you know, like the anti-fascist movement literally being fascist. It's just so funny how we're in this point today. But I want to go back to, actually, I had another point I wanted to make too, I thought was interesting about the waivers. CDC does this regularly with scientists where they go, well, conflict of interest, but because there's so few people, we have to give them waive. And they waive all of their people that work with big pharma, essentially. And they go, well, that's okay. You can come work for CDC, which is ridiculous. Same thing here. I asked the question, are they that limited on people for this position that they have to find somebody who has to be given a waiver? Like, and so if that's the point, if they can just give waivers, then why are the rules there to begin with? It just shows you that there's kind of this, it's a guise of having these kind of rules and restrictions. They pick who they want and they author waivers. You know, you have any thoughts on that?
It's essentially like it's a window dressing here when they'll offer you up that point of like, oh, look at this person, blah, blah, blah. And then obviously they bring in all these individuals. Whenever they're bringing anybody into government, you have to look at it. Okay, why are they bringing them in? Okay, we know all the other facts. Okay, what's the reason behind this? What are they going to do? What are their policies? What's their track record? That's what we should be looking at. And like you mentioned, the symbolic point of view, for instance, when it comes to Barack Obama. And I would argue, yes, look, on a symbolic level, like having a black president for African Americans is like a moment, right? It would feel good. Like, for instance, if I see Muslims in positions of power, it might feel like, oh, well, there's some more people there. But here's the thing. There's lots of people in the UK government who have Muslim names and backgrounds, but they represent the antithesis of what my viewpoint is. And so if they're Muslim, but they're for oppressing other Muslims and they're for bombing foreign countries and they're pro-Israel, and they're not going to stand up against what India is doing in the Kashmir, perhaps, then why am I celebrating their role? Really what this is giving you this idea and giving the society the idea as well that we have somebody to represent whatever given community and to make you feel like, well, you shouldn't really work as hard anymore because, hey, you have your token figure. But that in of itself, like you just said, is extremely racist. On top of that as well, it's bigoted as well because you come from the point of view, if you're celebrating this in an unquestioning way, you're coming from the point of view that all people that look the same way, share the same faith or what sexual orientation or whatever it may be, are the exact same when they're not. And this is the thing. During the Iraq war, there were plenty of Iraqis who were working with the Americans inside of Iraq on their missions to go and attack Iraqis, okay, and take down Saddam Hussein. Now, does that represent the majority view of Iraqis? Absolutely not. But here's the thing. When they go and they claim this, it's like, well, you're supposed to, by, for instance, ending the ban on majority Muslim countries, which Joe Biden has just done. You think that Muslims will be somehow on your side now or believe that the United States is not against them anymore when you're still in Yemen, at least for now, you're still killing Muslims in Iraq and in Afghanistan. You're still sanctioning Iran. You're still supporting Israel and its crimes against humanity, against the Palestinian people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, you know, if you have a brain and you're from said given community that they're trying to say there is better representation for, then you're not going to endorse this. And this is the thing. Like this is, I really despise it. I was speaking to you about a man named Frantz Fanon, who was an Algerian revolutionary speaker just before we came on. And he was one of those prominent voices during the Algerian revolution against the French who occupied the country. And it was a settler colonial project, essentially, at that point with these French settlers in there. And what he said back then is he'd describe a very similar thing. They try and basically provide window dressing and try and convince people, at least in the bourgeoisie class inside of or what can be considered as that at the time inside of Algeria, that, you know, things were getting better. There was better language being used and deceiving people back in France as well. And so when they're using this sort of language, and Edward Said as well wrote many books on this, and of course wrote Orientalism and Culture and Imperialism, which I think really help you understand these sort of concepts. He wrote about the way that this sort of language changes, the way the propaganda changes, because it has to over time. For instance, if we look at the colonial period, right, colonialism became a bad thing. But before that, it was a good thing, right?
Right,
right? So that language surrounded by colonialism, that went out of fashion. So now we have to use something different. And now we have to change the language and make everyone believe that we're doing something good and it's all acceptable.
Just like eugenics, same idea, right? It's something that was born in the United States. The Nazis picked it up and then, whoa, we got to distance ourselves from this. And they just sort of distanced themselves from the names and how it's called, but it's still alive and well today. I argue that's involved with the vaccine program today, as Whitney's pointed out. But yeah, it's interesting how they do that. And it's all symbolic is what it sounds like. It's all just about giving you things that appear to be leaning in the direction you think you want to go, but behind the scenes, it really has nothing to do with that. I think a good point on that, I wanted to make sure we talked about this, is this concept of sanctions, because it's a sort of the same idea, right? Where we're talking about something that is, they're claiming this is about helping people. Right. It's about doing this to save the Yemeni people, to save the Syrian people, to save the Iranian people. But at the end of the day, it's very clear, as we pointed out in the beginning, that this is designed to actually hurt those same people so they can achieve their goal, even if they somehow backwardly think that by hurting them, they'll eventually take over and then help them, which I argue is just ridiculously impossible. But I think it's important people to understand this. And then we can jump into some more of what foreign policy that's going on right now is. This is from the United Nations, and I pointed this out many times and even gotten pushback from certain people that go, you got to stop saying this, just to put this to bed. And I'll talk about this more in the future. This is a statement from the UN in October 2018 about literally unilateral sanctions. And that's exactly what's happening, because most people don't even think about this anymore. We should all know that sanctions are meant to be an international action. They're not supposed to be the US sanctioning one person. It's about a community idea, and unilateral meaning only one person in one direction like the US is in fact illegal. And it says right here, this is the title, unilateral sanctions hurting civilians must be dropped, according to UN experts. And it says unilateral sanctions that deprive innocent people of food and medicines must end immediately, according to the UN's special rapporteur and on the effect of sanctions on human rights. And it says, quote, unilateral sanctions that restrict nearly any financial transaction or which seek to prevent third countries from engaging in illegal trade with a country. That's the important one for me right there, are illegal and immoral forms of coercion, particularly when they harm the human rights of people living in targeted countries. It's very interesting, because this seems to fundamentally challenge exactly what they're claiming right now, right? One, that they have the power and the ability to do this, but this just, because people would argue, well, they're, you know, they lie. Oh, it doesn't stop the medicine and the food. That's why I think that one part was very important. That it stops them from conducting illegal trade. So that's, I mean, you could argue that's literally every sanction they're using, and that's the exact point, right? So what, first of all, any thoughts on that in general? And, you know, how do they get away with this still going forward? It's incredible that the UN is pointed to by these same people, but then ignored when they do something they shouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double standard. If a country which the powerful in this world don't like is to violate international law, then we instantly see UN Security Council resolutions against them. We will instantly see that sanctions will be slapped on and that they're going to be punished for whatever the United States, France, Britain, maybe even Israel as well, if they're, you know, trying to push for it too, will say, they'll be like, well, this country we don't like. But if we're looking at sanctions, for instance, on Iran, if we focus in on Iran at the moment and the sanctions which have been administered there, the United Nations have said openly, this is blocking medicine from going into the country. And so when we're looking at Iran and the lack of medicine that's allowed to go into the country, this is a clear violation of international law. This was brought up by the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Then the United States goes and threatens the International Criminal Court.
Right.
And there's nobody there to hold them accountable. This is the problem. The ICC, for instance, just dropped a few months ago a case which was pending where they were going to go in and investigate and perhaps even lead to prosecutions of British war criminals, people who committed war crimes inside of Iraq. And they just dropped it. And see, this is the problem, is that we don't have anybody which will hold the powerful to account, because there's nothing there which will push them to do so. If we look at the case of Syria right now, even Syrians I know who live in Europe, who live in the United States, find it extremely difficult to send money through to their family members who are living in essentially poverty at the moment. And people, of course, getting access to things like even fuel for their cars is extremely difficult. You know, their standard of living has dropped so significantly, especially due to these extra sanctions applied in the Trump era, this CSAR Act, And now we're looking at a situation where they're always telling us about, oh, donate to Syria. But the only place that they'll allow funds and aid to get into essentially in Syria is in outside of government held areas. So in Idlib, for instance, where the area is controlled by what's now known as HTS, which right. changed its name and made it so, you know, sort of Western friendly, and Sky News could go in there and film pieces with them. But they're essentially, they are al-Nusra Front or Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria.
Right.
And so that's the territory that you're able to send into. But the majority of Syria, which is controlled by the Syrian government at this time, it's extremely difficult to get anything into. And then, of course, like I said earlier, that spills over into Lebanon. And we're looking at the situation in Lebanon now. Just a few years ago, yes, there's always been corruption in Lebanon. Yes, there are Lebanese politicians that need to be held to account for what they've done and the faults that they've made over the years, absolutely. But these sanctions are inhumane. This is not to say that in the global South, leadership is not in crisis in some way, and there's not corruption and negligence, etc., in these countries. But the countries were functioning normally, relatively, to what they are now, prior to these sanctions. Lebanon a few years ago was fine. It was a nice place to live. Now, Lebanon is extremely difficult to live in for the majority of the people. If you don't have money, you're screwed in Lebanon, especially if you're in a place like South Lebanon. Okay, like, so
let's talk more about Lebanon for a second then in general about how this is an important point, because it's never black and white in any of these situations. That's the problem, is that we always want to see it in these binary terms. Is there are corruption. There's corruption there. There are people there that work with outside parties and people that work for the people. And so you can't just be like, the government is this way or that way. That's a problem. Same thing we deal with in any of these countries. So in this regard, how do you see this corruption? I mean, there's been regime changes, attempt for regime changes throughout history coming from these same powers. So where do you see that standing now? I mean, obviously, I would argue from what I can see that the government appears to be largely not overtaken by these outside powers, but there are people within these government factions that are trying to make that happen. Is that an accurate assessment? And who do you feel are the main people moving pieces in Lebanon right now?
Well, when you're looking at in Lebanon, there are certain factions which, of course, are under the thumb of the West, you could argue. So, for instance, Hariri and his bloc are pro-Western, pro-Saudi, for instance. But if you're looking at other political groups, like, for instance, you're looking at even the president, Michel Aoun, and his alignment with the likes of Emel and Hezbollah, etc., we're looking at groups which are not under the thumb of the West and are on the side of resistance in the country. And they don't want, for instance, Israel to come back in and take a bunch of land from them. So Lebanon is a complex picture. We have corruption throughout Lebanon. Absolutely. And no one will dispute that there's corruption in Lebanon. We also have, like, the problem is that the poorer the country gets, the more influence there is coming from outsiders, like Gulf influence, the Persian Gulf Arab regimes, their influence inside of Lebanon, and their contribution essentially to screwing the economy in Lebanon has been around for a long time. And we have factions which are aligned with Saudi Arabia or even the rich people from UAE. But at the same time as well, now the door is being opened to, for instance, Turkey to get involved in the country. France has attempted to get involved in the country. The United States is involved there. And this is what's happened from the very start. No one has left Lebanon alone. And essentially now as well, it's not like their Syrian neighbor, like, for instance, in the past, in the 70s, during the Civil War, we saw Syria would get instantly involved and it would negate perhaps in a way, like, of course, lots of Lebanese would be opposed to Syrian intervention. And I'm not advocating for Syrian intervention inside of Lebanon. However, it's not a regional thing now. It's an international thing. And Syria will have no power really inside of Lebanon in this situation. It couldn't really intervene at the moment. It wouldn't have the power to really do anything if a civil war broke out like it did in the past. And the factions are all different there now. And it's more divided than it was back then as well. And you're still having parties, for instance, that will take money from Israel to create mischief. Even if you look at back in the 70s with how the civil war erupted inside of Lebanon, we see that Israel and the United States, and specifically Israel, was sending money to the Falangist party, the Maronite right-wing militia party, in order for it to take over and essentially expel the Palestinians. And that was, at that time, it was about expelling the PLO and pushing the Palestinian guerrilla organizations out of Lebanon. And now it's a push to get Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese group, out of the country. And of course, Hezbollah is a lot more strong. It's part of the Lebanese political system. It's deeply embedded, so it's a lot harder. It's a lot more of an arduous task for them to achieve. Lebanon's obviously a bit of a complicated picture, but ultimately the general theme is still there, that they want to remove Hezbollah at any cost.
It seems interesting that anywhere you look, it's funny how we can see very flagrant what people would call terrorist actions, whether that's coming from Western countries or people out, you know, in any other place where it's, you know, politically driven violence that murders families and kills civilians. And it's, you know, whether it's by accident or not. And then you have the actions of people that they want you to see as terrorists that are pretty, not even arguably, clearly in another, you know, kind of vein of discussion here, where they're resistance groups, they're fighting for oppressed peoples. Now, yes, they act in violence in some cases, but how do you see, I mean, it's amazing to me how you can argue one is the same as, you know, that they are these terrorist organizations. But my point is that in every sense, you see the groups that they're trying to focus on, and every sense they're people that are trying to support or fight for groups that are currently, you know, that are being stepped on right now, you know. And that's what I think is so frustrating about all this. And it's not to say these groups don't do things that should be held accountable for, but as we pointed out in the past, that when you're, as the UN has made clear, these are groups that are in fact being oppressed, which means in the sense of this, of, you know, the UN mandate, they have a right to respond. And yet we don't act like that's even, you know, anything you can argue today in the way this all works. But I want to jump over into Syria here, because Syria obviously is a constant crossover with Lebanon, because Israel regularly violates the Lebanese airspace in order to bomb Syria and so on. And I definitely think Lebanon is a huge factor in this. I mean, I think we've talked about this in the past in regard to the Greater Israel Project and efforts in the past to try to take Lebanon specifically. So I think that's what this all ties into. But Syria, we can see that right now, it's, I mean, this is one of the things that has really gotten to me during all of this, is that not just Netanyahu, but Pompeo was in Israel the last time that they bombed them. 57 people died, according to some reports. It might be less or more, but that Pompeo was actually going, yeah, that was us. Like, we did that. Like, they openly took credit for a flagrantly illegal action. So Israel here, as Sarah is pointing out, and this is correct, bombing Syria, killing an entire Syrian family, including two children while they were sleeping. Where's the global outrage? It's incredible that this can continue to happen. So let's talk about Syria for a minute, and Israel's tie-in and Iran's tie-in, and how this makes sense at all. Because I find this is one of the most upsetting situations for me out of all of this right now, maybe save for Palestine, because of how obvious this is. Whether or not Iran is present, it's not legal to do what they're doing, and so on. So, you know, what are your thoughts on Syria, and is this what's going to ultimately happen, do you think?
Well, this recent bombing that just took place by Israel, of course, it killed four civilians, a mother, father, two children. It injured four others as well, according to Syrian media. Israel hasn't officially acknowledged it, doesn't really officially acknowledge it. Maybe at the end of each year it does. Last year it acknowledged that it struck 50 targets inside of Syria, for instance. But this was a massacre of civilians, and a lot of the press would say, oh, well, it might have been a Syrian air defense missile which caused this to happen, intercepting the Israeli missile, which it's not an excuse for what happened. This is an aggression by Israel against Syria, violation of international law. It's an act of war. It's a violation of the sovereignty of Lebanon as well, because these strikes were reportedly launched from over Tripoli. And so people in Lebanon could hear the jets when they were firing these rockets into Syria. This attack was in the countryside, the western countryside of Hama. And so if we look at this strike, the propaganda surrounding it, and this goes into the question of Iran and the other strikes as well, because this was the fifth strike so far within the space of a month on Syria by Israel. we're looking at it and they report that, oh, these were, they were targeting Iranian back sites. Now, as somebody who actually has sources inside of Syria, so I have sources with the Syrian air defense, people who write up post-mission reports, the Syrian military, and people operating inside of Syrian military hospitals as well. Okay, so sometimes we, if it's certain areas, we'll get information which will come in on casualties, right? So as somebody that actually knows a little bit about what's going on there and has sources there and has written for a Syrian newspaper as well, what we see happening inside of Syria with the strikes on the west side of the country, they're not striking Iranian targets. And anyone that is worth their salt will tell you that they are not striking Iranian targets. All the sources that tell you that they are striking Iranian sources don't have anybody there, any journalist there with any reputation who is reporting this. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is one. There's a media organization, I believe, operating out of Idlib, which is called Step News Agency, which came up with these bogus claims of an Iranian general being killed, for instance. And they claim instantly and quicker than sometimes even the Syrian media that, oh, 15 Iranian backfighters were killed in this area in this strike. And they don't give specifics, for one. There's never any information which emerges which will corroborate their claims. And on top of that, for instance, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, I believe it has sources inside of Idlib. I really do. I don't believe it has sources, especially knowing with the Syrians knowing that this is a project funded by the UK government, for instance, this Syrian Observatory for Human Rights operating out of Coventry, UK, one guy, right, who hasn't been in Syria for God knows how long, about 20 years or so. Okay. Why they would let people into these sensitive areas with Iranian militia people there, or how they would know that. It's just ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And then that goes back to the strike you mentioned, which happened, right, which happened in the east of the country, which I absolutely believe and I know happened, okay? The death toll, I don't know how to independently verify that. I don't actually have any like good sources, to be honest, inside of the east of the country. But one thing you have to know about the east of the country, in Deir ez-Zor and around Abu Kamal, where there is Iranian-backed forces based there, they have a base, there's no air defense there, so they can easily strike that. And if they want to hit Iranian-backed targets, they can do it in the east of the country. And they do it in the east of the country. But again, this doesn't stop anything from happening. If they want to get weapons through, they get weapons through. These bases, they build up the facilities back straight away, and they have more people, if it be from the Hashid al-Shabi, the Iraqi PMU, come back in there, they can send them back in there. And on top of that, Iran has been asked by the Syrian government to come into the country. You don't get to justify your acts of aggression and war against a foreign country. Oh, well, we don't like Iran, and Iran is threatening to us, and they're allied with this country, and they're there, and there's people that maybe Iran is backing that are there somewhere in the west of the country, so we can now airstrike them every 5 seconds and whenever we want. So, well, if you give that right, if you're not a racist with a double standard, right, give that right to Syria then, to Lebanon right. then, to Iraq then, to Iran then. That's fine then. If you're going to use that standard, then Iran could, with the same standard, launch a bunch of ballistic missiles at Israel because it goes, we think they're going to assassinate another scientist. We think they're going to launch
another cyber attack or another any number of things that have continued to happen. You know, it what's so frustrating about that is that, and look, it hasn't happened, right? As all the bluster and all the talk, and no, it's only a one way continuous story. You know, that's why I argue the whole Palestinian part of it is arguably to a large degree manufactured. I don't think there's actually that much going back and forth half the time, but that's just my opinion. But back on this in regard to Syria, I think it's so frustrating how regardless. So I want to dig into that a little more in regard to not being Iran, because I find that interesting. I want to know what you think their agenda is on either side, but it doesn't matter whether or not these are Iran-backed individuals, as we keep pointing out, right? They're invited by the government. It's a sovereign country. You don't get to just say, we don't like Iran, so we can bomb them wherever we want. And that's to your point. If they ever did that in the same regard, it would be the biggest issue of the century, and the media would not stop talking about it. And of course, the US and Israel would use that as an excuse to overtake their country in some way or try to, you know, and that's what's so frustrating about it is they know that they see this, you know, it's all manipulation. And it all comes from, I argue this, the Israeli concept. And I argue with the US and UK, I even, and I argue it, have picked it up, the Bethlehem Doctrine, right? The preemptive self-defense nonsense to argue that, well, we think they might be about to attack us. So what we're doing is not is defense, you know, and it's all about, you know, playing games with the words and making it out to be that you're the good guy. And that's what it comes back to. It doesn't matter that Iran's allowed to be there or that we think this or the law says that they're bad guy. So those things don't count. And we're good guy. So the laws don't count for us either. You know, it's like, that's how this seems to go, right? I mean, it's pretty ridiculous.
It's pseudo-intellectual nonsense, because even with the, like, for instance, there's official reasons given by the Israelis sometimes for why they attack, and these are the same sort of things. It's presenting an argument where you win either way, because it's like, you know, for instance, if you say, well, we believe that they were going to attack, and then there's some pushback, and you just claim, we believe there was an attack. Where's your evidence? Well, we just believe that there were indicators that maybe that had was going to happen. And it's like, well, I can't prove you wrong because there's nothing there in it. You can't prove yourself right, but everyone's going to take your word for it because you're right. Israel.
And
you're
that's the West. Right? And meanwhile, all of the mainstream Western media all comes out and reports that as absolute fact and just says, this happened, report. Right? Like, okay, wait. So if they get called on it, they say, well, we didn't say it happened. We said they reported that it happened. Like, that's pathetic, right? That's what they've been doing for a long, long time. And to your point before about the Iranian general, just to bring that up again, I want everyone to recognize that Robert was right immediately out of the gate about this story, because he actually had sources on the ground. And guess what? He's right. That story disappeared. They didn't come back and go, oh, that huge thing we said for 2 days, we were wrong, our mistake. They just throw it under the rug and move forward, you know? And that's the, where did that stem from? Was that also the Observatory for Human Rights?
That was Step News Agency that came from. And again, it was this claim. It was hilarious because following it, and I went to the very first source, and that was Step News Agency that reported it. The story changed about 15 times, you know, like, and it's insane. And then the Saudi media came out and produced a name, which was reported by other news outlets as well, uncritically. They just say, look, there's this name presented. And the name that they presented, like I instantly checked as soon as they're claiming this, because I was like, oh, wow, there were strikes, you know, in eastern Syria. I could believe that there were strikes in eastern Syria. Absolutely. You know, because there's no air defense there. Yeah, they could hit something. So I checked this out. And they were like, this guy doesn't even exist. Like, at the end of the day, like, there's no bit. And this is the thing, like, with somebody that's like, a general in the Quds force, you'd know, people in Iran would know, someone on social media would be talking about it. Nobody, like, because this guy does not exist. Like, he was not there. He was not killed. And the story as they presented it, it was hilarious, because by the time it got to the likes of the Daily Mail, right? At first it was picked up after the Syrian opposition media picked it up. It was picked up by the Israelis, of course. And the Israelis, they said, yeah, there were also strikes in the area, with 20 targets were hit or so, which just happened as well. But they didn't name the time where that happened. So, of course, because there was no timing, which was like specified, and some of those earlier Syrian reports said that it happened the week prior, when there was nothing reported a week prior, which is weird. Why would you not report if 20 sites were struck, for instance? And then because the Israeli media hadn't given a time scale between the apparent assassination of an Iranian general and the airstrikes, the coalition airstrikes, which took place apparently in Abu Kamal, like the Mail Online had picked it up and said that it happened at the same time. And this is how, and then others picked it up as well, right. And said it happened all at the same time. 20 targets were struck, and there was two Iranians in the back and one in the... And they were transporting weapons somehow in this car that they were in, four people. And first it was two people, then it was three people, then there was four people. And it just changed so much. And I was reporting that, and I got a lot of slack for that. People were like, oh, how could you say it's not, blah, blah, blah. How do you know it's not? Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, everyone shut up because that was the truth.
Right. And all the people screaming at you being fake news didn't swing back around and go, hey, you were right. My mistake. You know, it's like that never happens. And that's what's, you know, but it's always a thankless job. What we do is a thankless job, but to the most part, you know, and it's just about fighting again. The people that would argue that are online, Twitter, or wherever else, either are completely snowed by the people they're listening to and just would never admit that they were wrong, or they just don't care and never notice it because the media shifted directions. They're already off on something else and they don't even think about it again. They'll live the rest of their life assuming that person did die, you know, and that's what, and they know that that's how it works. Now let's talk about Yemen. We already kind of talked about Yemen for a minute, you know, a little bit. You kind of briefly went over different parts. So let's just say, I mean, I also want to point out before you you tell me what you think is going to happen here, because it does seem like you were correct, at least that they're reevaluating the designation of the Houthis. But yeah, I mean, Yemen is in my opinion, the best example, or the worst, however you want to say it, of how these sanctions are happening, despite the overt effort to starve these people. As you said, and as I've been screaming about since this, you know, since at least I took notice of it, it's the world's worst humanitarian crisis. I don't know why that's not the biggest, you know, focal. I mean, it should accentuate this point. We should all be going, oh my God, why is that not being dealt with? And on top of that, we have these at Saudi Arabia, the United States, France, the UK, all leaning on them at the same time and pressuring them, trying to get what they want to put their puppet back in place. But I think the food aspect of it, they're openly blocking the port, Bab el Mandeb Strait, Hudaydah port, and they're blocking it with the very intention of stopping that food to come in. Now that's a direct violation of what we just read for sanctions, and they do it anyway. You know, so it's like they don't even need an excuse; they just say they're bad guys. You know, so it's so unnerving to watch how that these are bad people, guys out there watching. These are bad people that are at the very least willing to hurt innocent people to maybe get rid of someone bad. Then you can discuss whether that person is actually bad or whether that's even what they're trying to do, right? But so where do you see this going with Yemen? You know, do you really believe that? I mean, because I personally believe that Biden and the administration it's all narrative. I think it's going to be the same thing Trump did, the same thing Obama and Bush and so on. But do you think that there may be a difference here in where they're going? I mean, it's good to think that they're at least reevaluating the designation.
Well, it could be to pressure Saudi Arabia. If they want something out of Saudi Arabia, even if they wanted regime change in Saudi Arabia, perhaps they will go a different direction. But even with the registration of Ansar Allah or the Houthis as a terrorist organization, the United Arab Emirates, which is essentially like a second Israel inside of the Middle East at the moment, right, for the United States, it's relatively independent. It has a vast intelligence apparatus. It has a very updated military and a lot of very intelligent people behind it. Very evil, but very intelligent. And they're deeply involved in Yemen, and we don't normally hear much about them. And in fact, earlier on last year, the Sovereign Transitional Council, which is backed by the Emiratis, because the Emiratis officially withdrew from Yemen in 2019, but still backed the STC. And so this group that's operating there was actually opposed to the Hadi government forces, which is the internationally recognized government, and Hadi being the internationally recognized president, which is backed by the Saudis. They were essentially at war with each other last year.
Let me ask you, Hadi, when you say internationally backed president, what does that actually translate to? How many people support this person? Because I can't find that much support for this individual that most people don't even know exists at this point.
Yeah, well, of course, he was driven out of the capital, Sana'a. He's in exile in Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia have propped him up as legitimate government, as a legitimate president and leader of government there. And that government is de facto set up in Aden, which is in the south of the country. And so the Saudi forces are backing his forces. But the problem is here is that he's just a proxy of Saudi Arabia. Right. And really, those who control the capital and who have their government, because Ansar Allah or the Houthis have their government. They have a government set up. You know, it's a proper government with a foreign minister and all, right?
And they're elected by the people, which is not something to ignore. You know, I mean, there was actual, I mean, at the very least, I mean, you could argue that it was manipulated, as they will always. But at the same time, just like with Bolivia, just like with Venezuela, the people elected, you know, and they're trying to shove back in who they want in control. Hadi is the Yemeni Guaido, in my opinion. That's the same thing.
Yeah, there's a similarity there. I mean, the Ansar Allah, they get knocked. And this is the reason the international community, for instance, will say that Hadi is legitimate, is because they essentially seized the capital, right? But the thing is...
We're clear, but there was later follow-ups in regard to the people, in regard to basically choosing them, right? Am I wrong in that?
Yeah, inside of that territory. But they would contest that and they would say, oh, well, you know, the people were forced, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and that's the narrative. However, you have to look at Yemen in the context of the so-called Arab Spring, which essentially erupted all over the Middle East in 2011 and led to some of the horrific circumstances in countries today, like in Syria, for instance, or in Egypt. It led to eventually the coup leader Sisi taking control, etc. We could go all over the Middle East. Didn't work in Bahrain.
My favorite quote for that, just so everyone remembers, is when he walked in the White House and Trump said, "Where's my favorite dictator?" That's a real quote, by the way. We all should remember that. Not a joke. I mean, we laugh about it. Like, we laugh when he said it, but I think that was a genuine statement. Like, it's sort of like with Pinochet and, you know, oh, he's a terrible guy, but he's our terrible guy. You know, it's, that's how they think. Yeah.
It is hilarious looking at Sisi, honestly, being in his position in a way. It's hilarious in the way that you look at Trump, right? And find it hilarious, or Bush, you know,
or alarming in the same way. I mean, the whole point of that was to control that part of the, I'm forgetting the strait again, but right, was that arguably the whole point of putting someone in power in Egypt, to control the flow through the canal?
Yeah, and so like that, and on top of that as well, if we look at Morsi when he came into control, he was proposing. At least, you know, he was still favorable towards the West under the table in many ways. And of course, there were problems with Morsi. Morsi was not, you know, a perfect leader. He's Muslim Brotherhood, of course, so he's aligned with Ikhwan. But when we're looking at what he put forth, he allowed, for instance, a lot to get into Gaza. He allowed the tunnels to operate there. At least in terms of the way he was speaking, he was anti-Israel. He was anti-United States. He talked about, you know, taking back the nation's wealth. And essentially, the country was crippled. He was only in power for a year. So, you know, we didn't get to see what he would do. But the people started to oppose him because of the conditions inside of the country. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that he was proposing, he was on a platform of being anti-West. He was working with Iran, you know. Right. He opened up their territorial waters for Iran, for instance, for trade. And so the direction Morsi was going in was too much for them. It was too much because they could not possibly let Egypt get back to the place it was in prior to Anwar Sadat signing and coming to Camp David and signing the so-called peace agreement with Israel. They couldn't have that. They needed to have control over Egypt because Egypt is a major base of power. It's a base of culture as well inside of the Middle East. It's, you know, it's got a great media and movies, and it has a great influence. And in the days of Jamal Abdel Nasser, when he was in control, this was a huge problem for the US, UK, France, Israel, and the region. It's a massive problem.
How much of these transitions and kind of moving around of, you know, positioning your pieces has to do with the flow of oil? So I know that's part of it, right? Coming, you know, talking about the Persian Gulf, talking about the Bab el Mandeb Strait, and all the way up to the canal. Sinai Canal, is that correct?
The Suez Canal.
I feel like I'm blanking on the name from the other side of it. Anyway, the point is that the largest factor there, or is there more going on in regard to control? Because arguably, when the inevitable effort against Iran happens, they'll close down their control of their waterway, which is the point. Which the discussion being is, well, Bab el Mandeb Strait could be another direction, but Yemen controls that as well. You know, that kind of idea, or at least is present in that location. So, how much of this has to do with the flow of oil?
In terms of Egypt or in terms of
moving these people, trying to go after Yemen, trying to, you know, toppling Egypt, going after Iran, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the war in Yemen is essentially, I mean, the objective would be for the Saudis failed, dramatically at it, right? They thought, you know, this would be an easy operation at overthrowing the Ansar Allah. But that was about placing pipelines through there. Right. And averting having to use the Strait of Hormuz, of right. course, which comes under, in the Persian Gulf, comes in under the control of Iran. And so you want to negate Iran in that. This is how you do it. And this is why, for instance, it's necessary on a strategic political level for Iran to back Ansar Allah, okay, as well as on humanitarian grounds or on ideological grounds, right, to aid them and to back them in terms of in the political arena or whatever it would be. This is one of the reasons, because they're trying to attack Iran with this move. And mm-hmm. so an attack on Yemen can mean an attack on Iran. So these things are very much interlinked. Yeah. Even with the United Arab Emirates signing this so-called peace deal with the Israelis, they're going forth. And when they had the meeting last year, I believe in November, when the first ever meeting, which occurred in signing in Ben Gurion Airport, they were basically agreeing to use an old pipeline, which was essentially set up in the days of the Shah to be used between Israel and Iran, and which the United Nations had said that that Israel should pay back trillions, essentially, for what they've done. Of course, they're not going to Israel's going to pay this, but essentially, the United Arab Emirates would use this, and now they're looking at starting the new what would be the new Hejaz railway, and so there is transportation of goods between the United Arab Emirates and a new sort of trade route, which is going to be set up to Israel. And this, in a way, would actually negate Egypt. But the thing is with Egypt is that they want to negate Egypt because they're scared to death of Egypt ever being that influential power at any point. Because if there is another revolution, if anything goes south inside of Egypt, right, they don't want them to be in as a major player inside of the region. They want to make sure that's impossible to happen. And they don't want any of these countries in the region to have that power. They hate it.
This is what frustrates me so much about the imperial chessboard, is that these moves directly influence and affect the lives of the people in these countries, you know? So what you're effectively doing is stifling this country's growth. And yeah, sure, that could end up being strategically dangerous for another government, but really these governments are just, you know, as we're told, supposed to be, you know, just embodiments of what the people want. And that's, we know that's not the truth. But so it frustrates me to watch how openly there's, you know, well, I guess not openly as much as, you know, we're talking about it, but they don't state that they're taking these actions that directly hinder the lives of the people in Egypt. It just makes me sick to see that's everywhere. Everything we're talking about today, all the different countries, it's direct imperialist action that's hurting the people on the ground. That's what we're fighting for here. You know, the people that can't speak. It's unfortunate.
Absolutely. And literally they cannot speak inside of Egypt. You're going to end up dead inside of a jail. There is I forget the name of the director, but there is a song. What's his name? Rami. I forget his last name. I think Rami Assam is his name. He's an Egyptian singer, sort of an alternative music. And he made a song called Balha. Balha is like a date, right? Mm-hmm. In Arabic, if you translate it, it's like a date, essentially. And this is something that, you know, Egyptians have made fun of Sisi. They say he looks like a big shiny date, you know? They look at his bald head and he's an idiot, right? And so this guy, this Egyptian man who filmed the music video for that song, was essentially taken into prison by the Egyptian authorities for this, for just filming, right, the music video and directing it, and he was killed in prison. Like, so they can't speak. And on top of that as well, it's like since the so-called peace agreement was signed, Anwar Sadat signed it with Israel, the former president of Egypt. Since that time, we've seen that economic aid to Egypt is the second highest in the world and one of the highest in the world. It's either first or second, and it goes up and down to any country on earth. And the reason for that is that they want to have them by the balls, essentially, right? If we're just going to speak straight up about it, that's what they want.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, because they cannot allow Egypt to prosper. If Egypt prospers, this is the end of it for Israel. If they come back, especially with modern military, it's done.
See,
it's
done. You know, to add to that same point before, as I mentioned before, in the same idea that it doesn't it bother other people out there that are maybe not aware of all things we're talking about, that Egypt, that's supposed to be, you know, that's a U.S. ally that they all support, they're giving some of the most support to financially, and that they can openly do what you just described. Just say, oh, we don't like what you just did on that film, arrested. Right. If that happened in Syria, Venezuela, Iran, it would never stop. They would, oh my God, look, they're just, you know, no rights, no freedom of speech. And they wouldn't stop talking about it. But they'll happily support someone like Sisi or someone like Bolsonaro or someone that openly is a dictator. It's just, or Saudi Arabia, for crying out loud, is a monarchy, a dictator. It's so stupid that we pretend we're fighting for these things while they literally support the vast majority of the worst dictators on the planet.
Yeah, and they did that before with supporting Mubarak inside of Egypt. And now with Sisi supporting him. Another thing is that Mohamed Morsi just died in prison. Okay, he died in prison. And so they kill people who are members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I'm not a supporter in any way, shape, or form of the Muslim Brotherhood. However, this is horrific. You cannot do this.
Right.
Like you said, you know, in a country like Egypt, with a coup leader like Sisi, who does anything that they want him to do, right, who is just an absolute puppet, not a real leader in any sense of the word, anything goes, basically. He can do whatever he likes. Right. And, you know, he destroyed all the tunnels going into the Gaza Strip, which they didn't just supply weapons into Gaza. This was the lifeline of Gaza in terms of all the different goods which were coming in to help people. And this was a form of jobs for people as well. And on top of this as well, it's Sisi now under Mubarak. Mubarak, at least, he was selling. He created a pipeline where he would sell, I believe, from Alexandria up to Tel Aviv, and he would sell resources to Israel. Now it's the other way around. They've reversed it, mm-hmm. and they're selling to Egypt. And so, like, on every level, they have absolutely been, you know, destroyed. The people are in a terrible position economically. And it's sad. It comes from, you know, the days of Jamal Abdel Nasser, who installed pride inside of the Middle East to this. And this is what they do. And even Saudi Arabia, mark my words, the second Saudi Arabia is not doing what they want, they will kick them out of power within 5 seconds, and they don't care.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, this is what, look at somebody like, I mean, you know, the PLO or the Palestinians in general. And I mean, there's different examples around the world where they claim, well, we're going to stop this because they're terrorists or because they do this or that. And the point is they'll happily give it to Sisi despite openly doing those things. And they can't even prove the ones you're saying over here. It's all hollow words. They don't really care. The obvious example is Syria, where it's not even a secret. The whole moderate rebels fiasco, we all know what that was. Everybody know. They got caught like 11 times throughout that process. They're funding terrorists because it's their terrorists. It's like Pinochet. It's our bad guy, right? It's the same thing. And that if we can see that happening, it demolishes any semblance of integrity in any other narrative they're pushing around all of this. And, yeah. You know, I think the last one, the ones I want to get into, I want to talk about Russia a little bit before we finish. But before that, I want to get into, you know, I mean, Iran is, I think we've talked about that so many times, and it's important to at least give us a little discussion of where you think it's going to go. And as well, you know, Palestine in general. But let's start with Iran, because I think that is this kind of linchpin, at least of the way they're making it out to be, of all these different groups of Houthis, of you know, the Hezbollah, of the, you know, Palestine or the Hamas. You know, it's all, they're all trying to tie it back to Iran. So in general with Iran, how do you think that is going to go forward with the new administration in regard to Israel? Is it going to become more aggressive, or are they going to, I mean, I think arguably they want to give the illusion of more for the Palestinians, but I don't think they care or want to do that. So how do you see that happening going forward?
Well, we know in terms of what they're doing in Palestine, it's horrific, following on from what Trump's done. But when we're looking, and we'll get into that a bit more in a minute, but if we're looking at Iran, they said, you know, Joe Biden coming into power, he was saying, well, we're going to get back in the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. Now, if they do that, they can avert some of those tensions. But the problem is they are now making it conditional. And Iran says, no, the original deal was good. You're the ones who pulled out of it. You had this unilateral withdrawal from it. And so it's your fault that you got out of it, not ours. And now, of course, they're enriching uranium. They're taking a number of steps in order to indicate that, hey, look, if you're out of it, we're out of it too. And if you return to it, we'll return to it.
But I always want to insert the point right there for people to understand too. And I've said this a million times, and I'm sure you pointed to it as well. But the point that both Article 26 and 36 in the JCPOA, but specifically 36, makes it very clear that if the U.S. does exactly what they did, that Iran is they're allowed to do exactly what they're doing now, incrementally increase until it comes back to the table, right? So just so we're aware, there's not their actions are a breach, but allowable within the deal because of the U.S. actions. That's just a nuance that people need to understand, because they make it out to be like, look at them breaching the deal, they're threatening everybody. And it's like, no, even the IAEA has said, yeah, it's, you know, that's they're increasing it, but it's allowable. You know, it's, they just hide that part from us. So please continue.
Yeah, and on top of that, to add to that, Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. There's no evidence to suggest that it has one. Anyone that's telling you there's a nuclear weapons program does not know what they're talking about, because every single reputable international body will tell you that there's nothing there, there's nothing to indicate that they have one. And so the only ones saying that essentially before were the U.S. Trump administration and Israel. And there is experts inside of Israel as well who would say that, no, JCPOA is a good thing. There's nothing to indicate a nuclear weapon. And in fact, JCPOA would actually work to avert them getting closer to a nuclear weapon, of course. And it does, because it on paper, it does anyway, because Iran has stated that they don't want to get it. But if you don't believe Iran and you believe Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, I don't believe that they are. Purely because I believe that at this point, with how advanced Iran has become, it could have achieved a nuclear weapon a long time ago. But let's say on paper, you know, they're enriching uranium now more because of being out of this deal, because there's no incentive for them to not, right? Why would they not enrich uranium, which they can use for multiple purposes, not just nuclear weapons? And so they're doing that on paper and getting closer to a nuclear weapon. So like it's obvious that JCPOA would work to avert a nuclear weapon, right? Or enriching to the point of getting to a nuclear weapon. But when we're looking at this, if the United States is to say, well, you know, and Antony Blinken is to get up there and go, well, if Iran does not, you know, throw away its ballistic missile program, and get rid of all of its offensive weapons, essentially, and get rid of all of its alliances, then we're not going to get back in this. Well, nothing's going to work, because Iran's not going to give it up its alliances in the region.
I argue they know that, and that's exactly why they did it. That would be my take on it. They know they'll say no, so they can look like we tried. I mean, that's usually how they play it, you know?
Yeah, they could do that. And I mean, that, for me, could be indicative of the Biden administration wanting to create a proxy war with Iran. And I've said this a few times on your show and on the Foreign Policy show as well. And I've covered this as well extensively, even on my own YouTube channel, because I like to try and educate people about this and let them know that this is happening. But the best way for them to try and do that from their strategic perspective would to be use the Azeris, ethnic Azeris inside of Iran, in order to get them to uprise and attack the Iranian government. And there's 20 million ethnic Azeris inside of Iran, and you just need 1% of that population. You've got 20,000 people if you can arm them all. 200,000 people, and if you can arm them all. The height of the insurgency at Syria only reached, you know, the largest estimates of fighters against the Syrian government would have been about 150,000 if you combine them with ISIS. That's the largest estimate. A lot would have it less than that. So this is a huge problem. Then on top of that, what factors into this is what we've just seen with Azerbaijan and Armenia as well. And on top of that as well, if we're to look at this now, Turkey's forces, their proxy forces, these so-called Syrian rebels, right? Many of them were in Al-Qaeda-backed groups or were in organizations like Jaish al-Islam, which was backed by Saudi Arabia, are now on the border. These crazy militants who literally did put people in cages so that they'd be the first ones to get bombed and to try and deter bombings of certain areas and, you know, gassed people, skinned people alive, ate their hearts, a whole litany of terrible things. These people are now on the border with Iran from on the Azeri side, Azerbaijan side. And so they could easily spark conflict with Iran. And if Azerbaijan gets on board with an Azeri uprising inside of Iran, this is a huge problem.
We had talked about this in the past. That's right. And so do you think that the conflict happening between those two is engineered in order to achieve that goal, or potentially
with Armenia?
Yeah. To set up exactly what you're talking about. Is that why we're seeing this conflict happen?
It could have had a dual purpose. I mean, this is a very long-running historic conflict.
I should say Stoke, yeah. And as we saw it recently.
Yeah, well, it could be. I mean, that's possible that that could have been an aim of it. However, I can't, like, having not investigated that as, you know, why it came up and all the rest of it, and not having knowledge of, you know, exactly who were involved in stoking the tensions, I couldn't really tell you that at this moment. So if I commented on it, it would just be speculation. I mean, yeah, technically, yes. And it definitely had the dual purpose of setting that up. So we could believe that. We could be led to believe that. But I can't say that from a point of view that I have researched and understand.
It's certainly a possibility, right, that it definitely ends up being sort of a, you know, benefit to you know, the agenda in large, whether that was made to happen or not, is clearly, I would argue, benefiting that potential. Now, I'd also ask the MEK. How does is there tie-in in that regard, in regard to the group you're talking about with the MEK? Because obviously we see on this end of it that they're clearly pushing the MEK, or at least they were up until the Trump administration. We'll see where this is going. But we know Giuliani, Elaine Chao, and all sorts of people would be paid to speak for the MEK, as if they were, and they openly stated, Bolton stated, that they would be put in power once Iran was removed. Right. So is that falling off now, or is that still tied in with the group you're discussing?
Well, the MEK, of course, being the terrorist organization that it is, which sided with Saddam Hussein in the war against Iran and hence has little to no support inside of Iran, is basically used by the United States in order to do smaller scale attacks, you know, create civil unrest, you know, small attacks on military bases.
So they're like herds, essentially, and they'll be sold out the moment that they don't serve a purpose. Is that what it sounds like?
Exactly. That's exactly the sort of function that they have. Is like, I mean, looking at what the United States has done with the Kurds inside of the SDF specifically, if we look at inside of northeastern Syria, that they back them to the point where, well, it's fine if you're fighting with us to take the oil fields away from Daesh, but hey, you know, the second Turkey comes in, screw you, you know, and that's what they did. They didn't back them. And even like before as well, when Trump was not in power as well, there was many moments where they just left them to die. So, you know, they don't care about Kurdish people or the Kurdish liberation movement and all that stuff. They don't care. They don't care at all. They back them for their certain given aim. And it's the same thing in Iraq as well. It's the same thing. Like, who's there to back them now? Like, I mean, like the United States used them and the Barzani regime for a long time in northern Iraq. And there's a lot of instances where the United States just ditches them. And it's the same thing with the MEK. If the MEK turned on them, they would be a terrorist organization again. They would be like making sure they kill them all and put them all in prison. But because the MEK plays ball, and, you know, it gets its money from Saudi Arabia, and it gets backing from the Israelis sometimes, and it will get backing from the UK and France and the United States especially. And MEK is good now. Let's just forget all of the bombings which killed tens of thousands of people inside of Iran, civilians. Right. Just normal
civilians. Americans. They've killed Americans as well. I mean, this is
still Americans,
ignored, you know, no big deal. You know, all because it serves a purpose, which is the point. Just like we see Saddam Hussein one day as the supporting U.S., and now next day he's the biggest threat in the world. And Osama bin Laden's a warrior of peace one day on the Washington Post. The next day he's the biggest terrorist in the world. It's funny how that works, right? It's like all these terrible people at one point were supported by the U.S. It's weird that we don't put that together, you know? It's so frustrating how that train continues, you know? Oh, every place we're looking.
And this it funds in this like runs into the propaganda as well, because when we're looking at what they call a terrorist organization inside of the Middle East, it's like, well, they'll lump in, you said this earlier, they'll lump in Daesh, Al-Qaeda and other groups and the Taliban to Hezbollah and Hamas, which are not, they're distinctly different. They're so different that there is little that makes them the same. And they came out and they have different aims. Like, for instance, Hamas and Hezbollah, both of these organizations, yes, they're described as terrorists by the United States and by Israel and by the EU and et cetera. But these organizations, for instance, Hamas, in its amended charter, it supports a two-state solution. It's about national liberation for the Palestinian people. It was an elected government inside of the Gaza Strip. It was elected democratically to power. It participates in democratic elections and norms, and it's attempting to get back into that now with the PA trying to involve itself with that and the election process, which apparently is going to take place this year. And so that organization, yes, there's plenty of things you can disagree with them on, but they're nothing like Al-Qaeda, which is just, it doesn't have popular support from the people. It was never a charitable organization like Hamas. Its roots were in the Mujahideen Islamiyah, which was not Hamas. This was the priest, like what basically was before Hamas, and Ahmed Yassin and these other figures were part of. And that's actually an interesting thing in terms of, we'll probably talk about this another time, in the formation of Hamas and a lot of the claims which are made about them. But when we're looking at it, that sort of an organization, or Hezbollah, which came out of the 1982 invasion of Lebanon, where 20,000 people were killed, and again, helps greatly in their community, is a political party involved in the Lebanese political process, and is not just about, like, they won't kill you just because of your political identity. You know, they're not like Al-Qaeda. Like, even me, and I wrote this in an article for Last American Vagabond, like me being a Muslim, right, a Sunni Muslim, although I don't like identifying with these titles, but if I was to live under Al-Qaeda rule, they'd kill me. Mm-hmm. They'd kill me. They'd probably chop my head off. Hamas or Hezbollah, which is a Shia organization, would not do that to me. There's right. They would do nothing to me. Well, so... it's a completely different thing, different aims, different objectives, and they're not the same thing. Even when they're using violence, it's not the same aim. It's not, they don't kill people in the same way. They're not as horrible.
Context matters. Nuance matters. I mean, that's the problem, is that they're just lumping everything. When they want to, nuance is everything. But when they don't, it's just broad brush everything they can, you know. Since you brought it up, and, you know, we in general, there's only about, you know, really, I want to talk about Russia a little bit and good time on Palestine. But since you brought it up in regard to Hamas, it's an interesting discussion. I'm sure, again, we could probably do an entire video on it. But yeah, I mean, the discussion is that Israel had a hand in creating what this is, and people would argue whether or not it was used for that very purpose and so on. I've come to understand that there's much more there, that it's, you know, yes, there was a potential use of it in the beginning, but it's broadened out and so on. So for people that would ask that question, how do you see that?
What you just said is a sort of good summary of it, to be honest with you. When we look at Hamas as an organization, Hamas became Hamas as an organization in 1987. And it came out and really emerged during the first Palestinian Intifada or uprising, right, which occurred. And so at that time as well, again, it was a Islamic charitable organization and political party, and it wasn't much about armed conflict. It got involved in, yeah, throwing stones and that sort of stuff, and, you know, pushing the nationalistic line. But at that stage, there are allegations that Israel, for instance, wanted Hamas to counteract Fatah, the PLO, because later on, especially around the time of the Oslo Accords coming up, they wanted a counterweight. But when the Oslo Accords were signed, Hamas started using violent tactics in order to avert those accords and try and get rid of them and to resist against the Israeli occupation forces. And when they actually got armed in the 1990s, that's when Israel never again, I mean, you could say that they use their attacks as justifications to attack them back, but you could say that about every single Palestinian organization in a similar way, whether it be the PFLP or DFLP, or it will be Fatah or any other organization which existed in history of the Palestinian conflict. We can look at all of them and say, look, well, these reprisal raids which happened in Lebanon or in Jordan were the result of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and all of those which came under it. So that argument can be made there. However, the funding of it from Israeli sources, that comes during the days of what I just mentioned before, and that's the Mujahideen Islamiyah. The Mujahideen essentially was a charitable organization. It was like a social influencer. And this was at a time where there were no peace deals with Israel, right? This was at a time where there were still guerrillas fighting as part of the PLO and different groups inside of that against Israel. And so
this is at a time where they're an occupied location and under the UN, that's not an illegal action. They, regardless of the sides you may have, what they're doing is allowable in the rules of war, if you will. And that's important to remember.
Yeah. And we're looking at inside of the Gaza Strip specifically that this organization emerged. And the Mujama essentially did things like trying to make the society more Islamic. And so it was funded at that time. The Mujama was funded by Israel through back channels. And there's confirmation of that. And they were allowed in many instances, according to people who were observing it at the time, they were allowed to sort of take positions in the hierarchy under occupation in Gaza. They were allowed by the Israeli forces as well, which is common. If anything bad's being done in front of them, they probably allow it to happen. So, and we saw the Sabra and Shatila for crying out loud. They allow horrible things to happen right in front of their eyes, encourage it. But for instance, when Hamas members, religious people who were, you know, over the top, who'd attack people for not wearing headscarf, or would beat people up for drinking alcohol or something like that, or being too exposed at the beach or something like this. And it was a push to make people more conservative and to also divide politically the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, because the Mujama, other than doing that, it wasn't just doing that stuff. That was a minority of what it did. But what it did is it provided massive aid to Palestinians, and it provided them with this Islamic identity, which started emerging. But after that, we saw in the latter years of the Mujama and its action, right, as a big organization, that its leading figures like Ahmed Yassin, for instance, who was the spiritual father of Hamas, he was the founder of Hamas. Ahmed Yassin was arrested on weapons trafficking charges. So they were also playing that dual game of trying to get at the Israelis, because they wanted, now that they've been established, to do something, right? So they sort of used that. And Ahmed Yassin was put in prison for it. And a lot of these other leaders were put in prison for it. And we look at, even up into this day, if you need evidence that Hamas is still targeted, Ahmed Yassin was killed, Rantisi was killed, like all of the leadership essentially get assassinated by Israel via airstrikes, anybody that's speaking up. And right now, you know, Israel, yes, they used Gaza as a punching bag from 2006 after what happened in Lebanon when they got defeated by Hezbollah. And up until essentially 2014, yeah, that they used it as a punching bag. They used it as an order to get back their deterrence capacity, you know, the Arabs' fear of them. But one thing for sure is that at this moment, Hamas presents a real problem to them. And its weapons are better. And like at no time before, Hamas now is more able to actually dictate when it wants to engage in conflict. And Israel's more hesitant to attack them for this. Now, the small bombings, all right, but if they want to launch a war, it's a bit different, because Hamas will pull out bigger weapons.
Well, that's an interesting point. So in general, what we constantly see, and this is really as the world at large, all they see in this dynamic, unless they're paying attention, is they hear Gaza fires rockets and Israel responds. And that's the only way this gets framed by the Western media. And every single time, and I mean like every single time, and it's almost absurd. It is rockets fired, no damage, no injury, open field. I mean, every single, and it's absurd until you find an example where I argue there was actual rockets fired from Gaza, and you find, but so my question would be, not only is that dynamic played with and manipulated or outright falsified, but you're saying that they have other weapons in general. So I would argue that, you know, why would they ever use a rocket with no guidance system that gives Israel the excuse to hurt them, other than maybe a quick show of force to show people they're doing something? But even then, you're giving Israel the opportunity to just openly bomb wherever they want, right? So why would they use those rockets, and why don't they ever use the other ones in this regard?
Well, in the past, using those sort of flimsy rockets, that's all they had. So in the past, those fireworks, as they've been described by the likes of Norman Finkelstein, for instance, who's a leading scholar on Israel-Palestine, it was a show of force. It was something to show that we're resisting. And the only real resistance which happened during 2012, 2014, 2008-9 was on the ground. So if the Israeli forces came to them, the fighters in Gaza are significantly tougher and know their environment more, and are willing to sacrifice more. And you know, against, they're not even nearly as well armed, right, and prepared, but they're able to pull off victories against Israel in a way that Israel's not able to handle. So that's where the real victories came. But in terms of the rockets, it didn't do much. Now it's a bit different. And like the show of force thing you said, if it's a small thing where Israel are bombing targets, not killing people, and they're just blowing things up in their show of aggression to their, for their own people, they might do the same thing. Sometimes as well, it's not just Hamas and Islamic Jihad, which is the biggest, the other biggest organization there, which is backed by Iran. That they're not just the organizations which have rockets. Also, smaller factions, less significant, less well-funded factions have rockets. And so sometimes these rockets accidentally actually go off.
Right.
So,
yeah. Or what about the possibility that there, you know, that, or at least the question should be asked, what about Mossad? What about the CIA? What about simply pretending there was something that happened for the justification? The question that I ask in this, yeah, and this is why I'm so skeptical, is more than just different comments by one of the leading munitions experts in Israel stating that the Iron Dome is really just a bunch of, it's just a show, it's an illusion. Now, I don't know if I've ever verified that, but that's interesting, stating from someone like that. But the idea that how come we never, and I've never once seen a video of one of these rockets. I only ever see video of the Iron Dome exploding, but there's never a trail of a rocket in the after, before the point that they explode, right? Never. With all of the cell phones in Israel and some that would be in Gaza, probably less, are of course less, the point would be that there at some point there would have been one caught on video. And I'm not saying that there haven't ever been, but in these constant back and forths, it's always that one side. So how does that make sense?
There are occasions where we've got a lack of video of it. I mean, there are a lot of instances where I have to be given like an exact sort of example to tell you whether there is anything which emerged or not. Mm-hmm. But I mean, even in the cases where they'll claim something was fired into a field the odd time or whatever it may be, and there's no alarms going off or anything like that. I mean, why even claim that, like, you know, no alarm systems went off, no one knew anything happened, nobody's seen this munition that was apparently fired, and then you suddenly claim that it happened, right? So there's no Israeli panic, but you're claiming that happened, and therefore you bomb like 15 targets or something,
right?
So yeah, I mean, and it's possible, I'm not ruling out that there could be people operating for the Israelis there. I rather than actual Israelis operating there, it's people that are blackmailed by Israel to work there. So Palestinians that are blackmailed, that are on their payroll.
Right.
And it's a dangerous thing to do, because if you're found out to be a collaborator, you're going to be executed. Like, because essentially what you're doing as a collaborator with the Israelis, you're giving locations where the Israelis are going to bomb and kill people.
And this is war, though. And it's not like important to understand that, and not that, you know, whether you agree with that or not, the point is this is an open war. Right? That's your country, wherever you are, would do that too. Right. So it's funny how we frame things different when you are told one guy bad guy, one guy good guy. You know, it's the same. People are fighting for what they believe in. All right. That's what it really boils down to. But so with new weapons and potential directions in that regard, where do you see this going? Do you think it's going to continue to be this little back and forth? Do you think that possibly Biden will do something that benefits them? I mean, I think the two-state solution is you've made that clear. It's a joke. It's ridiculous. So where do you see that future for Palestine?
Well, Joe Biden claims he's going for a two-state solution, the so-called two-state solution, and Antony Blinken even said it. And like I said at the Senate confirmation hearing when he was talking about it, he said, yes, we're for a two-state solution. We believe it's the only viable thing to have a Jewish state, right? And not that they care about the Palestinian state, and didn't mention anything about that, but Israel being a Jewish state, and that's the thing that they really care about. And in a way, that's true. It is true. A two-state solution would have been the way for Israel to actually have been a Jewish state, but that's impossible now because of the settlement. So they've made it an impossible solution. Either it can be an apartheid regime now, or it can be an open democracy. And it's clear from what they've said, Antony Blinken saying, we're good for the Arab normalization. Oh yeah, settlements, but they haven't said anything about the settlements which were just announced, like around thousands of them. I believe it was 5,000 new settlements which were announced altogether in the past week or so. Nothing he said about them. It's not going to change the location of the embassy or say that they don't recognize Jerusalem as the capital anymore. So, and he's going to do nothing about the settlements which are cutting off East Jerusalem, essentially, and isolating it from the West Bank, whether that be Ramallah or that be, you know, towards the Jordan Valley or down towards Beit Lahem and El Khalil and other areas, right? Some of these names might be absolutely meaningless to people that don't really know the conflict or the areas specifically even, but I have to note them anyway, because my brain is weird. But when we're looking at it, if he supports just the fact that the normalization deals are a good thing, and Blinken wants to go ahead with Joe Biden and get more Arab regimes involved in normalization, this is the death of a two-state solution, even as an idea. There cannot be a two-state solution. I mean, geographically now it makes no sense. But if we're looking at it, the only bargaining chip the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah has, its negotiators have, are the Arab normalization as a result of a peace deal. So the Arab Peace Initiative set up in the early 2000s, and they reaffirmed it again and again, which was backed by pretty much all of the Arab countries, and it was initiated by Saudi Arabia, was this idea of land for peace, and we're going to make sure that there's a viable two-state solution for the Palestinians. And then we all agree, this is what they said, we all agree that we will normalize relations fully with Israel. Right. We'll sign trade deals with them. So that is actually a big incentive for Israel to actually make peace, because it's going to go, oh, wow. You know, like if we sign a peace deal with the Palestinians and give them this little 22% of the land here, then every single Arab country is going to be cool with us, and we're going to get a lot of money. So that's a massive incentive for Israel. But now when you take that away and they don't have to create a two-state solution in order to have normalization, then it's dead. There's nothing. Yeah. Palestinians don't have anything to negotiate with other than violence. And that's what they're doing. They're pushing it to violence.
Exactly. Exactly. And I would even go a step further and argue that what the reason that's happened is because the Israeli government doesn't in any way want a two-state solution or peace with the Palestinians. And I think, I mean, they've stated this openly. I mean, different parties, different politicians, it's clear that there, you know, yes, there are some, as you pointed out, that definitely have different ideas. But by and large, the leading parties seem to be leaning into the more extreme opinions in Israel and saying, okay, well, you know, basically driving it in that direction. And that's what I think all this amounts to, the continual, whether real or not, the idea of creating the conflict, making it out to be that they're the ones breaking the deal. Like all this stuff was driven and set up by the Israeli government, right? Because if, like, think about what you just said. If you have every single Arab country that's going, yes, yes, we want this peace, and only one country that's essentially stopping that, or even the fact that it's one versus all the rest of them, doesn't that paint a picture of who the problem is in that scenario? You know, it's just so funny. And yes, that doesn't necessarily prove that's the case. It's possible that they're all wrong and they're right, but it's just stupid that we ignore those kind of things. And it seems obvious that they're say one thing and don't want, and then act a different way. I mean, that's every single time, as you've painfully covered, that it's just constant that they say, we want a two-state solution. We want peace with them, but then they circle back and do actions, speaking of the Israeli government, that absolutely undermine exactly that. It's really sad.
Well, the Israeli regime itself now, if we look at the government as it is, obviously it's led by Netanyahu's Likud party, but we're looking at, like, even in the past, now the opposition figure of the blue and white party, Kahal Levan, his name is Benny Gantz, and he was the opposition in the past three elections. Now they're coming off to their fourth election in around 2 years. He's dead now in the water. He's not even a candidate. And this guy, he was presented by the Israelis as being a centrist, but he's not. He's a longtime Likud party member. He oversaw, for instance, the worst thing he oversaw perhaps was the bombardment of Gaza. He was the head of the military in 2014. And his campaign was ran on, I'm strong on security, I killed 2,000 terrorists, right? Most of these people were civilians, but 2,000 terrorists and all the rest of that. And he was anti-Palestinian. Now, the number one figure, Benny Gantz, is gone now, right? The number one figure to Netanyahu, right, is a guy who's further right to him. His name's Gideon Saar. Right. Now, Gideon Saar's new party, right, Gideon Saar, again, he's an ex-Likud party member. His platform that he's running on is worse than Netanyahu's. Now, Netanyahu is a far-right leader who wants to align with a religious, hardline religious element to his government as well in order to form it, not just the himself, a secular extremist, a right-wing extremist sort of line when it comes to Palestinians in the region. We're looking at a guy who's worse than that. That's the Israeli political spectrum. For instance, the Labour Party in Israel, which before had a strong support base, doesn't exist anymore. It's like it has no support. It's dead. It's nothing. It barely makes it into the Knesset, according to all the polls, right, which is the Israeli government. And the other thing about this as well, if we look at the Israeli political system, in all of this is the fourth election, right, they're going into within 2 years. They could have formed a unity government. They could have formed a government, either Netanyahu or Gantz, both of the past times, essentially, with the Arab Joint List. Mm-hmm. They didn't, because they will not even consider an Arab party being in the government. It's just that, it's that whole, like, again, that window dressing BS that, oh, look, there's Arabs that are allowed to have a political party in our country, which these are Palestinians, by the way. To call them Arabs is an insult. It's really an insult to them. But they're allowed to have a political party, the Arab Joint List, which is all of these parties together. But we're never going to include them in a government, even if it means that our country is politically divided, that there's hundreds of thousands of people all over the street protesting and causing mayhem, and there's this huge divide and all the rest of it. And all of those Israeli parties, which potentially could come into government, the ones that actually have any power are right wing, far right wing. And it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So that's the Israeli political situation. And none of them will ever consider a two-state solution. Never.
Exactly. And that's not a secret, right? I mean, it just speaks to the aggressive propagandized, you know, the social engineering, the manipulation of your populace. It's the same thing we're seeing with this country or the UK or anywhere, that they're using the media to aggressively radicalize people, you know, and that's happening right now. I argue that's what I think they're trying to do with half this country. You're creating the radicalization you then use to justify what they're clearly pushing as a domestic terrorism effort, right? Same thing I would argue here, is that they're radicalizing people to such a degree that, you know, and look, it doesn't mean that there's not people that definitely have already held those opinions, but eventually with enough propaganda and social engineering, you can get people to convinced that that child over there is trying to murder your family. You know what I mean? And that suddenly it's no longer about terrorism. It's about doing what's right. You know, that's what it all comes down to. And it's just propaganda. These are people that have lives and self-determinate, you know, they want to do what they want. I mean, I always point to Gaza in the regard of how you have people that are just not allowed to leave. I don't know how you can argue that in any way is their fault for anything if you're in a situation from which you can't leave, or you have 97% of drinkable water, or all the things that you pointed out. You know, it disgusts me that this is okay because we claim they're bad guy, or however you want to frame it. You know, it's unnerving. And I definitely think that this is going to get worse. I don't want it to get worse. I don't want to predict horrible things, but I feel that the picture and the evidence paints that. I mean, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think as well, the top Israeli human rights organization agrees with this too. They've just came out and said in their latest report that they put out that Israel is an apartheid regime. And this is Bet Selem, the top Israeli human rights organization, is, in my opinion, one of the very best, if not the best, on the conflict in terms of the information it presents, how well thoroughly they research everything, they report everything. They include in their organization both Palestinians and Israelis. And this is a very reputable organization. And they've came out and said it's an apartheid regime. Like, because that's what it is at this point. You can't have it two ways. They say, well, we have what they call the West Bank. The Israelis will call the West Bank Judea and Samaria. They don't call it the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And they say, yeah, the Judea and Samaria is ours, right? And Gaza is a problem, right? But Judea and Samaria is ours. So if all of that land is yours and it's rightfully yours, and every Israeli will give you the map, which includes the Jalon, right? If they're going to have a map, that's what their map is, if they're going to wear a chain, right? And this is Israel. And so if this is all Israel and there's no prospect really for a Palestinian government or a two-state solution, you operate in an apartheid regime, because right, you've got over 5 million people in the occupied territories who don't have equal rights, who are completely, in the case of Gaza, is the most horrific circumstances you could ever imagine. And the United Nations had ruled as of last year that Gaza is unlivable. But that was, you know, the first that prediction in of itself came in 2012. Later in 2018, we had their predictions confirming that those predictions were wrong. It's already unlivable. And so we're looking at the West Bank as well, with the settler colonies there, where only Jewish people live, which means that this is a racist apartheid system where they're living in a European style village that they've created with walls behind it, guarded by a standing army or a city.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they got different roads that they can go on and everything. And it's not apartheid. And then on top of that as well, your undivided capital. I always tell people this undivided capital. They say this is the most hilarious thing I've ever heard them say, is undivided. Literally, there's an apartheid wall in the middle of the freaking capital, which anyone who goes there can see if they want to, in East Jerusalem. And there's settlements littered throughout. And there's settlers inside of Palestinian homes, which you kick them out from it. It's like, it couldn't be more divided, literally. And people in West Jerusalem don't even go and see Palestinians. The only time they could grow, I know I've met Israelis who don't know anything about Palestinians in East Jerusalem. I've never met them. Have never, like, don't have any friends with them, wouldn't talk to them, don't want to ever talk to them or know them. They literally live in the same city, right? And they don't even know that the Palestinians over there, they don't have some of them. They're like, oh yeah, they have the same rights as us. And I remember talking to one of them in West Jerusalem, and I was like, no, like, most of them have Jerusalem IDs, so they can vote in the municipality elections, like for the mayor or something, but they can't vote for in the Israeli elections. Hmm. And they have no access to things, and there's a discriminatory policy in terms of building houses, which is meant to ethnically cleanse them, which has been enshrined since the overtaking and the occupying of East Jerusalem since 1967, which you can track back. And they don't even know. They have no idea about what the Palestinians are going through. And the settlers are cool with it, of course.
It's incredible. I mean, what bothers me more about the whole thing is that whether it's the government people we're talking about or the people that, you know, have seen it in the place you're talking about, they know that this is not correct. They know that what is being presented to the world is inaccurate, and they don't care. This is the post-truth world that's absolutely been engineered into existence, except it's the opposite way they claimed it would be, where they're the ones full of nonsense. I mean, it's amazing to me. All the stuff we talked about today is clear. It's obvious. It's there. It's fundamentally, I mean, Netanyahu can stand up and say this is the state for the Jews alone, and was actually in response to somebody who I believe was Israeli who was saying, no, there's equal this and equal that. And Netanyahu came up and said, no, this is the state for the Jews alone. And that doesn't show us what we're, but yet they can come out and say, no, it's not. It's totally equal on the media or with Donald Trump or something like this. It's just, it's unnerving to see how obvious it is. And go ahead.
Like an end point to that is, if you look at this and the supremacy that's there, which is not just against Palestinians or for instance, people put them in a different category, the Druze there, right inside of Israel. It's also with the Jewish people there as well. There's a hierarchy, you know, for instance, white Jewish people are on top. They're on top of everything, okay? And then you got Middle Eastern Jews who are discriminated against, Black Jews, which are discriminated against. So it's not equal. And on top of that, like, this is the main point I wanted to make to sort of finish on what you were saying. They cannot argue, because if from a liberalist human rights perspective, you cannot argue what they're arguing. You can't. They'll lose every single time. So the only thing they can do is attack you and smear you when they end up getting into a conversation with you and say, that's fake news, or oh, Pallywood, the hilarity of Pallywood. They said, this is one of the things they say, Pallywood, that you're making it up. That video of a child being smashed in the, it's not even real. You're not showing the throwing of the stone before, but something like stupid. But it's like, for instance, back in the days of slavery, right, or Jim Crow, mm-hmm. people arguing against them and saying, according to human rights or according to, you know, liberal principles, right, which we claim to hold to, right, you can't justify this. And they'll go back to you and be like, oh, well, we'll try and find this loophole. At the end of the day, they can't argue from a liberal perspective or a human rights perspective. or any of the things that, you know, are espoused by Western countries from those sort of perspectives, they can't argue it because it's the same thing as arguing for slavery. It's racist. Right. So exactly. These racist things are literally built off of it's this ideology that one group is superior to the other group. One group's rights trumps the other group's rights. And you can't argue that from a moral perspective because that moral perspective doesn't exist. There's no foundation that it lies on.
And this is exactly why they make out this is why for a while, which I can't believe it ever was even given credence, the idea that they're all terrorists, those kind of things were floated exactly for that purpose, which, I mean, nobody says that anymore because that's just stupid. Well, some people I'm sure say it in some places, but in my circles and, you know, where what I'm seeing, I don't even see that even floated anymore. I saw the last time I saw that stated was an interview with, what was his name? George Galloway and what's her name? I forget. They're not one, the one with the dark hair, Laura Loomer. And he had her on his show to call her out for that claim. And swear to God, she defended it like crazy. And it's so embarrassing. You know, that doesn't age well, right? You can look back and she's screaming that everybody, like my argument is always like, okay, so that's not even a good analogy, but the point is in regard to Palestine, because the analogy I was going to argue was for people that say that all Jewish people are the same. And the argument is, well, that my neighbor just had a baby. Is he immediately evil because he's Jewish? Like, it's a stupid argument to say that anybody is like that, but that's the same thing that she was doing. And I argue that's what it all comes back to, is they're all terrorism, evil people. And so who cares that we're breaking all of these rules and human rights?
I mean, yeah, you throw back on its head. And any of these things which were said about Palestinians, you say the same thing about, if you were to flip it and just replace the word Jewish with Palestinian with Jewish, and read that out on paper and what it sounds like, and you'll know instantly what it is. But it's again this propaganda, and we could go back to even, I don't know, war on Vietnam, or what if we go back further than that, to the Japanese people who Japanese Americans who were put into concentration camps as a result. Look, that was justified on what basis? They were U.S. citizens. But it's that whole thing of Japan, or, oh, yeah, the Viet Cong. And whatever country they're going after or whatever group of people they're going to go after, they're going to have this propaganda so that they can essentially justify killing them. And this is the most thing, like, this is the most important thing in terms of racism as well, because everyone goes on about racism and identity politics. But it's like, you do understand that racism, like the racism from, you know, the idiot who down the street that just hates people for what they look like, is not as dangerous, right? It's obviously not nice, but it's not dangerous like it is from the elite who dress in these nice suits. They'll use all the language they have to use for the day, but ultimately it's that pseudoscientific false crap. And that's what's projected to you 24/7 about Muslims, and it's Muslims today, and it's whatever group they go after tomorrow. You know, it doesn't matter. Whatever group. You know, and that's why, for instance, back during slavery, they created the pseudoscience to say that black people were inferior, because back then they needed the scientific argument, right? The pseudoscientific argument.
And this is where eugenics played a part, right?
It's
about just claiming purely by bloodline or by birth or, you know, whatever that, you know, it's literally racism, right? That's what it is. And we're Yeah, exactly. And this is what we see in all these cases. And you're right that this is much, much, much more dangerous to come from the elitists, I would argue. I've tried to stop calling them elite because that's sort of a compliment in the way the word actually works. They're elitists. Because when you look up elitists, that's different. They think that about themselves. That's how I talk about it now. But you're right, because what they're doing is building these. It's not just, like you said, your neighbor who hates people. It's a government who is creating an entire society of people who justify that hate. That is crazy alarming. Now, to finish up here, because I know we started off everybody to shoot for an hour and we're going, but this is important stuff to talk about. I wanted to finish off with Russia in general, because this is a perfect way to end, because it wraps up everything we've been talking about. And this is so incredible that Eva Bartlett calls this out and says the U.S. Embassy, in Russia at it again. Advertising protest today, complete with meeting points, times in multiple Russian cities. They also list their contact info. Perhaps contact them with your thoughts on U.S. interference in Russia. And she points out, here, let me show you the actual link. Actually, excuse me, hold on. She had it back here, right here. It's just hilarious because if you look at it, they're basically telling you that there is going to be a protest, right? Media sources indicate that there's going to be these demonstrations. And sure enough, by the way, this is before it has started. Sure enough, she's right. And here, breaking news, French press agency, the U.S. condemns the harsh tactics of Russia against these protesters. Now, sure, is it possible these were just genuine protesters? And is it possible the U.S. is just totally upset with the way they're treating them, despite them doing that themselves in every other circumstance? Sure. It's possible. But what I think this is, and this is why Eva Bartlett was pointing this out to make her point, is that they are setting this up because Joe Biden is clearly taking a harsh stance against Russia, and they need to set up the same old rigmarole. They're going to start with a fake protest. They're going to start with manipulations. Whether or not that's what this is, that is what this government does. Not Biden versus Trump, not left versus right, but our government, the U.S. government. This is their modus operandi. So what do you think about this, Robert? What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously, they get involved in countries where they just should not be involved, especially if they've got like an embassy, which is attempting to agitate. That's not your role inside of the country. It's supposed to be diplomacy. And I mean, Biden's been presented as a rational figure opposed to Trump. But on this, well, not too rational, is it? I mean, he has said that they want to get back in the New START agreement, which is the Obama era deal. So that they want to extend that for 5 years. So that would be a positive development. But at the same time, there's a load of different treaties that Trump pulled out of, which could be used to justify war, essentially, now that these sort of loopholes have been created to justify war and to have offensive forces in places where they couldn't before, according to these treaties. So when we're looking at this, I mean, this is it's an example of what, for instance, they've been doing inside of Hong Kong. Now, right. Hong Kong, like, is of course, there's this whole, like, you know, there's supposed to be two systems and all the rest of this. And there are people in Hong Kong which are angry at it, what China has been doing and the dominance it's attempting to assert there. But at the same time, we see that the National Endowment for Democracy has been working there. CIA agents have been on the ground. And these
And pictured there, I think it was actually the State Department, but there was an individual that was actually pictured in I think it was the airport with a bunch of the leaders of that movement. And we still go, oh, no, that's nothing. They're just supporting democracy.
And it's a similar thing here with what we're seeing in Russia, though. I guarantee you that there'll be organizations involved in this, and the condemnation comes directly. They'll end up, I don't doubt that there'll probably be some sort of punishment against Russia for this. They might. Exactly. Place more sanctions. So that's a very big possibility. On top of that as well, something which was alarming, which Blinken had stated, is that they're still considering Georgia as for its application to become part of NATO, which would essentially immediately put the United States at war with de facto at war with Russia. So that's something that we have to watch. And then, of course, there's the close relationship between Biden and Ukraine. These are dangerous moves, and Biden is acting in a very dangerous way. You just come into office, and this is the first thing that you're going to do is to start, you know, not a de-escalatory sort of stance where, okay, we're going to send an ambassador, something bad is happening here, we want to solve it. No. Yeah. It's like, we condemn you.
Before we even know what's going on the ground, we you know, you're Russia, so we know you're doing this, so we're already condemning you. Like, that's the narrative. It's not about they're using the opportunity to condemn whether or not this is even what they think it is. And I argue probably actually making this happen. You know, the Ukraine's a good point, though, because Whitney just brought this up as well. It's so absurd that we have someone like Biden who is clearly support, you know, this the fascist white supremacist country of government in the Ukraine. And this is we're talking about Biden, who's being pushed out as the person literally fighting against fascism. It's absurd how Americans can't recognize how they're being played in this way, you know?
Yeah. It's just like they don't care about, for instance, him being the author of the crime bill, him supporting the right. Iraq war, or for instance, for people who care about the LGBT, he voted against gay marriage. But like, they just ignore these things. It's like, yes, progression. It's like,
well, yeah, they argue that people are allowed to change their opinions, which I agree with, right? He can change his mind and vote later differently. But what we know is that very recently, their actions will show you who they really are. But what's interesting is that most of these people don't change their votes based on their opinions. They change it based on what they think is popular. That's what these politicians are. And that's what's so absurd about all this. You know, the rigmarole of politics, it just continues down the line. But I think this is going to continue in every regard. That's my, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, everybody, but I clearly believe that Biden's administration is just, whether Trump or Biden, it's our government that has the same agenda. It didn't change because Biden's in power. The narrative changes, which Robert pointed out himself. It's, you know, it's a few tweaks on what we think is most important, and the war continues. Now, Trump, yes, he definitely claimed to draw down, but what he really did was shift things around. He didn't really move much. And at the end of the day, I would argue the most that's going on is not even necessarily U.S. troops these days. I would argue that they utilize a lot of proxy forces as well as mercenary forces. And that, I mean, even somebody even just pointed this out. I believe it was Iraq. I don't want to misquote it because I'm remembering off the top of my head, but there was a location where they said, it might have been actually Syria, but they said, okay, well, here's how many troops are remaining. That's before Biden put them back in. And it says, but that doesn't count to something like 11,000 troops that were considered contractors. It's like, that's clearly the force. Like, it's not, you know, we move 2,000 troops and we're out of Syria. You know, it's so silly the way they frame all this. But the point was that I definitely think this is going to continue. And I wanted to share this on the way out. Actually, where was that? I thought I had, maybe I lost it. it was Blinken talking about, there it is. And Blinken, what you were just referencing, by the way, talking about their direction, what they're going to be doing. And what he said clearly here is, we will continue to stand with Israel, even if we are the one country on earth to do so. And it just shows you that this has nothing to do with what's right, with what is, you know, I mean, doesn't the collective international opinion, isn't it supposed to matter? I mean, he himself points out in this clip here that they're talking about all these biased UN mandates up against Israel that everybody said that they were the only one that voted against. So it's like, at some point we have to go, wait a minute, is everyone in the world wrong and you're right? Or is it the other way around? You know what I mean? And it's like, it's the same thing you would tell a child. It's like, well, maybe you're right, but doesn't everybody else disagree? So at least consider the possibility that you're the one that's wrong. You know, it's interesting, but this gives you a good indication of where it's going to go. What do you think?
I think it's these double standards that they have, and like, they can't ever consider for a second that they're wrong, but they operate with different principles, but they can't tell you that their principles are different or what they're seeking is. Like, if they tell you the truth about what they're actually seeking, you're going to be opposed to it because your values are different to their values, right? Their values are driven by money and power and wanting to be like having these imperial interests in the region. And interests which most Americans or people in Britain or wherever else wouldn't align with. And that's why they need to feed you all this stuff to make you hate people, right? And feed you propaganda and manufacture your consent. And that's what they've been doing all of these years. And so the way that this is going now, I mean, there's still the threat of them going to war with Venezuela. There's still the threat that perhaps they'll launch some sort of proxy war against Iran. They're ramping up tensions with Russia, and it looks like they will go more and more into that direction. This is like, we see this just from the first sort of days in office of Joe Biden. And then on top of that, we have as well the aggressive acts towards China, and the fact that they don't want to sort of repair relations with China as well. So on all levels, they're aggressing. So, you know, when every single country on earth seems to be, you know, your enemy, again, it comes back to what you said. Well, is everyone else wrong? Like, I mean, you're looking at Iran, no nuclear bomb. It's like, you're the only one to drop that nuclear bomb on civilians, you know?
Right. Well, it's nuts. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I finished.
Well, just the point here that, you know, it's important to note that just because everybody else disagrees does not always mean that you're wrong, right? That's always, that's something I thought about right after I said that. And it's important to note, because we're not saying that that means that they're right or wrong. The point is that it's important to consider that in the context of whether you're right and wrong, because especially today, thinking about things like COVID and how all the media is screaming one thing and we're going, well, no, that's not true. It's, you know, it doesn't mean that you're wrong, because there's a lot of stuff out there, but it, especially when it comes to dealing with human life, you know, it's not something that you should just casually dismiss that, oh, well, they're all terrorists over there, right? That's what they want you to do. They want you to lose that empathy that you have for human life. They want to remove that from you. So, and especially where they, in particularly where they want to go, right? Like you pointed out earlier, one day it's Muslims, the next day it's this, and they're using it to diminish what you think they are. And that is something that we need to recognize. And I definitely think this is going to increase. I it's not something we should hope for, but the only way we can stop this from happening is by making sure people are aware of what's really going on, speaking out about it, sharing information, and speaking up and doing something. As always, I'm not talking about a violent revolution. Now, there are times for violence in history, like even from a libertarian standpoint, right? When you're being attacked, when you're defending your family, and I always say this, but we need to do something. We need to be standing up and talking about this stuff and pushing back against the narrative, because people's lives matter. Syrian lives matter. Yemeni lives matter. Like, we don't just get to pick one day. Human life matters. And that's what was important to have you on today, Robert, for people to understand that these are entire communities, entire cultures that are being attacked, diminished, extinct, extinguished. And we need to do something about it and not just let it happen around us while we're pointing at something else, you know? So thank you for being here and bringing everybody up to speed on all these topics.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sorry, there's a little bit of delay here. I think we're losing the connection at the end. But yeah, I know, it's great to have you, man. And we got to do this more often, especially because of my focus on COVID-19 and everything else. And I want everyone to know as well on the way out here that tomorrow I'll be doing a show possibly tomorrow, if not Monday. And I will dive through all the very important things that are happening with COVID-19. It just never ends. There's never an end to new things that are popping up, new information about people, Hank Aaron's dying after getting the vaccine, you know, Larry King dying, all these little things that tie in with the story. We'll get into it all tomorrow. But Robert, thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing all this information. And as always, everybody out there, question absolutely everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.